In this lecture, we will finally do integration. And this leads up to the famous Stokes' theorem. Let's begin by asking why it was that we placed so much emphasis on differential forms. What is so special about them? After all, they are just tensors. They're covariant tensors that are totally endosymmetric. Now, it turns out that they are special because their anti-symmetry means that they have special transformation properties under changes of charge. Transformation properties that match those of the determinant of a Jacobian. And that makes differential forms, and only differential forms, suitable for integration. It turns out that when you want to integrate some S-dimensional manifold, what you're really integrating is an S form. You can only ever integrate differential forms, because that's the only object that transforms properly under change of coordinates. So while the differential forms have the right transformation properties because of their anti-symmetry, there is one slightly non-trivial thing, which is that there might be a minus sign that is non-trivial when you integrate. Which is to say that the Jacobian, the determinant of the Jacobian might differ from what we get when we apply the anti-symmetry in the differential forms. There might be a discrepancy of a minus sign. We'll have to take care of that. So before we define integration on manifolds, we need to define the notion of orientation of a manifold. Consider the simplest possible case. Let's say a one-dimensional manifold. Here I'm drawing one embedded in R2. So our one-dimensional manifold runs from a point P to a point Q. And M is the manifold. What's a chart? A chart is a diffeomorphism that maps all points of the manifold into some patch of Rn, in this case R1. So our point P is mapped into the point alpha of P, if alpha is the diffeomorphism. The point Q is mapped into the point alpha of Q. And all the points in between are mapped into those points in R. But then we could have charts that do it the other way around. We could define a chart, let's call it beta, which actually maps P into the other end of the interval and Q into the first end of the interval. So it's just the other way around from what we had over here. And all the points in between, of course, go into the points in between. But then remember that integration is sensitive to the sequence of the integration boundaries. If we integrate a function over R from A to B, then we pick up a minus sign if instead we integrate from B to A. So we need to make a decision here how we want to integrate, one way or the other. In the case of R, the decision is easy to make. We just say this is supposed to be smaller than that. A positive function gets integrated, we want a positive output. But this is not ordered here. This is not in any way lower or higher than that one. Only the diffeomorphism decides where what is. And if we do this for n-dimensional manifolds, then there will be a generalized version of doing things one way or the other way. We can have coordinate systems that are left-handed and others that are right-handed. We have to make a decision here. And for n-dimensional manifolds, we may even need several charts. We may not even get away with such a simple picture where the entire manifold is mapped with just one diffeomorphism into a patch of R or Rn. And that makes things even more complicated. Not very complicated, it's just a bit tedious. Okay, so here's some definitions. A complete collection of charts, that is to say an atlas, that is to say a set of charts that cover the manifold completely, is what is called oriented if among all overlapping charts, whose coordinates we might call x and x tilde, the Jacobi determinants are always positive. So if we do a change of coordinates, then we get a Jacobian dx tilde by dxj, that's a matrix. We can calculate its determinant. And if all those determinants are always zero, always larger than zero, then we say that this collection of charts is oriented. What it means is that we are not going from left-handed to right-handed. We are always either staying with the right-handed ones or we're staying with the left-handed ones. And the manifold is called orientable if it possesses an oriented atlas. A Möbius strip is not orientable. Now, a manifold M, together with the choice of oriented atlas, is called an oriented manifold. And we will generally work with oriented manifolds. The assumption is that space-time is orientable as well. Then, relative to an oriented manifold, that is to say, a manifold with an oriented atlas, an arbitrary chart may be called positive or negative, depending on whether its Jacobian determinant happens to be positive or negative relative to the charts of this atlas. So we can work with left-handed ones or with right-handed ones. Doesn't matter. They are all defined relative to the to one orientation that we may choose for the manifold. Now we are ready to define integration itself. Let's say we want to change coordinates in ordinary integration in Rn. So we have an integral. We integrate the function g of x1 to xn, dx1 to dxn. We integrate that over some region Rn or even over Rn itself. This could be defined the Riemann way or the Lebesgue way, for example. And now let's say we want to change coordinates. We want to change variables in that integral. Now, changing variables in an integral doesn't change its value, of course. It's just another way to calculate it. So let's say we want to change variables from the variables x1 to xn to variables x1 tilde to x1 tilde n, to x tilde n. I assume you all remember what happens when you change coordinates in an n-dimensional integral. What happens is that you have to evaluate the function now in terms of the new variables. So the g is really a function of the x, but the x are functions of the x tildes. So overall, we obtain now a function of the x tilde. That's pretty simple. It's just concatenation of two maps. But also, the change of variables in the integral measure produces this determinant of the Jacobian. That's, of course, why we were considering the orientation earlier. So we have this determinant of the Jacobian in here. If our change of coordinates is such that we go from left-handed to right-handed, then the determinant is negative. Otherwise, it is positive if we keep the handedness. Now we want to generalize that for general differentiable manifolds. Let us consider a manifold M and some n-form omega on it. Remember, n-forms, if the manifold is n-dimensional, n-forms are the highest degree differential forms that there are. There is no non-zero n plus 1 form, for example, because you cannot anti-symmetrize n plus 1 different objects there because there are only n different ones. only n basis vectors of one form, and you can anti-symmetrize only up to n of them. So it's a top form, the n form. There's only one of them. At every point, the space of n forms is only one-dimensional. Differential n forms are always of the form of a scalar function, or just a, you know, a coefficient function, multiplied with this n form. We've made a choice of bases, but it doesn't matter which choice of bases we make. Then, what is the representation of that n form in an overlapping second chart? Well, if we change chart, then omega, the n form, will be given by that coefficient function evaluated at x, but x is a function of x tilde. We went from a chart x to a chart with coordinates x tilde. And we get all those Jacobian matrices in here because we change bases in the tangent space, in the cotangent spaces. Remember, we had this transformation rule here. So each of those, for example, the dx1 under change of variables goes into dx1 by dx tilde I1, and then you have the dx tilde I1. The dx2 under change of coordinates becomes dx2 by dx tilde I2 summed with dx tilde I2. Oh, and I should say I stopped writing down sum over I1, sum over I2, sum over I3. I think you've all seen the Einstein summation convention that any index that occurs twice is assumed to be summed over. Okay, so we have simply taken the n form, expressed the coefficient function in terms of the new variables, and we changed bases from the basis of the differentials to the coordinate functions xi to the differentials to the coordinate functions x tilde I. And we obtained those Jacobian factors as we always do when we change these bases. We calculated that earlier. Now remember that this thing is totally anti-symmetric because it's the wedge product. But we have here a tremendous sum. We're summing over all I1 over here. No, x tilde I1, we're summing over all I1. We're summing over all I2, all I3, all the way to In. Which means that, for example, we get in here a term which is dx tilde 1, veg dx tilde 1, veg dx tilde 1, and so on. Or we get also terms which are dx tilde 1, veg dx tilde 1, veg dx tilde 2. All of those terms vanish because of the anti-symmetry. Only those terms survive in which all of the dx's are of different indices, because only those can be totally anti-symmetric. So even though this is the sum where we have n terms because of the sum I1, n times times n terms because of that sum and so on, so we actually have n squared terms to sum over, most of those don't really contribute. Only those terms contribute where each of the indices from 1 to n occurs exactly once. All other terms are vanishing because of the wedge product. So in particular, the terms that survive are of the form dx1, veg dx2, veg dx3, I mean with the tildes, of course, all the way to dxn. And then there's another term where two of them are interchanged, another term where three of them are interchanged, etc. So we get all permutations of all indices occurring exactly once. We can reorder that. We can reorder those terms that they are all of the form dx tilde 1, veg dx tilde 2, veg dx tilde 3, up to veg dx tilde in. And depending on whether we had to do an even or odd number of permutations to get there, we get a plus sign or a minus sign in front. And you see what happens when we do that? The sum of all those terms is actually the determinant of this matrix. Right? Because the determinant is given by the sum of the product of all terms where a plus or a minus sign arises depending on whether we have an odd or an even permutation. So therefore, the n form in the new coordinates takes the form of the coefficient function evaluated at the new point times the determinant of that matrix, which if you spell it out is indeed of power this sort of coefficient to the power n, right? times dx tilde 1 veg, etc., up until veg dx tilde n. So what happened was that we started with this representation of our n form, which is the coefficient function, and then this on the side. And then we ended up with that coefficient function and this for the differential form part. Let us compare that with this equation up here. What we have is that our integral over a function in one coordinate system is given by this expression in another coordinate system. In another coordinate system, we have to evaluate the function now at the new point. And then we have to do just an ordinary integration as always. But also, we have the determinant of the Jacobian in here. Exactly the same way that we have down there as well, the dxi by dx tilde j. See, the dxi by dx tilde j. That's why the differential forms are chosen to be the totally anti-symmetric covariant vectors, tensors. If we had chosen them contravariantly, this would have been messed up. We would have had the tilde up here. Now, what that means is that the following definition of the integral of n forms, we can now define what it means to integrate over n form. Integrate n forms over n dimensional manifolds is chart independent, is coordinate system independent, and therefore well defined. The definition is this. Assume M is an oriented n-dimensional manifold, and assume that omega is a top form, it's an n form, which in a chart, let's call the chart alpha, takes this particular form. It's some coefficient function times this n form, which is simply the veg product of all the basis vectors of one form. Then we define the integral over an n form of that manifold. So if we integrate the n form over a manifold M of dimension n, it is by definition the usual integral, according to Riemann or Lebesgue integration, of the coefficient function and the usual measure of integration of Riemann or Lebesgue, where the integration region is the image of our manifold under the chart map in the patch of Rn. This is the definition if one chart suffices. If several charts are needed, then we have to piece it together as a sum over the various pieces. And for this to be well defined, we need the manifold to be orientable so that we don't have ambiguities with the changes of chart arising. So here we have the abstract thing. We have the abstract manifold, something like space-time itself. Here we have an abstract form, differential form. It's got to be a form of the same degree as the dimension of the manifold. So in space-time, you can only integrate four forms if you integrate over volumes of space-time. If you want to integrate over only spatially, you can integrate three forms. If you want to integrate over areas, you have to integrate two forms. Okay, so this is a differential n form. This is an n-dimensional manifold. And you don't need any d's over here. This thing is already a differential form. The integral over a differential of a differential form over a manifold is by definition given by that. And this is coordinate system independent. This definition is coordinate system independent because if we change coordinate system, what will happen? When we change coordinate system, then according to Riemann and Lebesgue, all that will happen is that we get exactly the same formula, except that there will be tildes here, and there will be a determinant of the Jacobian. Now, here on the same deal, as we just showed, when we change coordinates, when you change chart for a differential n form, then all that happens is that this function here, the coefficient function, changes and becomes the coefficient function times the determinant of the Jacobian. That's why this definition, even though it is written down in a chart, is chart independent. Now later we will also need a special kind of n forms that we can integrate over n-dimensional manifolds, of course. But that special kind of n form also has another use. It will be useful for the definition of Gauss's law. So let's just define that special kind of n form as well. An n form omega is called a volume form simply if it nowhere vanishes. If it's everywhere non-zero, then it's called a volume form. And intuitively, it's clear why you might call that a volume form. It's because when you integrate it over a little piece of your n-dimensional manifold, then you get never zero. If the piece is non-zero in size, then the integral, which you might call the volume, would also be non-zero in size. By the way, this is a curious definition here. As we will later see in general relativity, we can define volumes before we can define distances. Right? We're defining here volume forms. We can calculate volumes as soon as we have a volume form. We don't need a metric for this. We don't need affine connections, parallel transport, or any of that. Later, it turns out that the metric on space-time will induce a natural volume form. But in principle, the volume form could be chosen independently from the metric. And I know of some papers that have pursued this. So in any case, an n form is nothing mysterious. It's just a volume form is nothing mysterious. It's just an n form that nowhere vanishes. And it turns out that a manifold possesses a volume form if and only if it is orientable. As you can convince yourself easily from what we said earlier with the change of determinant sign business. Now, finally, we get to this boundary operator that I mentioned earlier to you. Remember the D we call the co-boundary operator. Now we define the boundary operator. Assume that G is some sub-manifold of N. It's a region. So we say it's an open and connected subset of the n-dimensional manifold M. Let's say we take three-dimensional space and we cut out a sphere or a ball or a cube or something like this. Then if M is an n-dimensional manifold and G is an n-dimensional subset of it, is an n-dimensional submanifold of it, a region We call it a region if it has the same dimension as the mother space from which it is cut out. Then it will have a boundary which has dimension one less. Just like if you take a globe, if you take a half sphere, the half sphere is two-dimensional. It has a surface only. But its boundary is the equator, which is one-dimensional. And in general, if you have an n-dimensional manifold, its boundary will be n minus one-dimensional. The boundary manifold of our region G will be denoted by del G, where del is the operator that sends G to its boundary. So del is the boundary operator. Del G is the boundary of G. For our purposes, we will it will suffice to restrict attention to boundaries that are what is called smooth, that are themselves smooth manifolds. And we say that a boundary is smooth if locally there exist charts such that they look like an n-dimensional Rn. So basically, if M is the manifold, if what is indicated in red here is some region D, then del G is the boundary of it. And we say that the boundary is smooth if there is a chart which maps this piece here, which maps any piece that contains some part of the boundary, into Rn in such a way that the boundary is just a straight plane in there. It's just an n minus one dimensional plane in Rn. So if it can be straightened out by a smooth chart. Which is just to say again that the boundary is smooth if it locally looks like Rn minus 1. It turns out that if the manifold is orientable, then any region within it is also orientable. And if you take the boundary of the region, del G, then that boundary inherits the orientation of G. Now we have all the ingredients. All the ingredients for one of the most important theorems in mathematics, one of the most beautiful theorems in mathematics, namely Stokes' theorem. The Stokes' theorem says that if we assume a few mathematical niceties, so the closure of the region G is a compact n-dimensional region. Basically, just assume that G is smooth, its boundary also is smooth. And G is a finite volume region. Then the integral over the exterior derivative of a differential form over that region G is given by the integral over the boundary of that region of just the differential form. Of course, if G is n-dimensional, then dG has to be an n form. D omega has to be an n form, which means that omega is an n minus 1 form, and that matches with the boundary being n minus 1 dimensional. Okay? If S is an S form, dS is an S plus 1 form, we can therefore integrate over S-dimensional manifolds, as S plus 1 dimensional manifolds. And here we have an S form, which we can integrate over an S-dimensional submanifold or a boundary of G. Now you can also see why it is justified to call the exterior derivative the coboundary operator. See, we have here two ingredients. The outcome of this is a number, okay? The integral. It's a number, like 5 or 7 or whatever. And we have two ingredients to produce that number. We have the region that we have to integrate over, the manifold that we integrate over, and we have the differential form. And we can either say that we evaluate a differential form over the region, or we can say that we evaluate the region over the differential form. Either way, you put the two things together, you get a number out of it, the integral, right? So what we see here is that when we integrate the exterior derivative of a differential form, then we can alternatively drop the exterior derivative and integrate the differential form over the boundary of the region. Or we can say that if we call this now the co-boundary operator, we can either integrate the co-boundary over the region, or we integrate the differential form itself over the boundary. So we can remove the co-boundary operator at the expense of putting the boundary operator over here. We can remove the boundary operator over here by moving to the co-boundary operator over there. So we have two things. We have the integration region and we have the differential form. And we can move the D either to act on the differential form, or we have it act on the region. When it acts on the region, it's the boundary operator. When it acts on the differential form, it's the co-boundary operator. It acts either on the one element or on the other. Let's see what happens when we iterate Stokes' theorem. Right? It would seem that this is perfect. Here we can integrate over an n-dimensional manifold. That's an integral over an n minus one dimensional manifold. If we keep iterating this, we integrate over an n minus two dimensional manifold, then iterate again, n minus three dimensional manifold. Eventually, we integrate over zero dimensional manifolds. That's just evaluation of a function, right? It would seem that's pretty nice. Doesn't work. That collapses. But why? Let us try iterating Stokes' theorem. So let's say our region G is the boundary of some region H. So the manifold G is the boundary of some manifold H. Then let's look at the formula in the middle. We are integrating some differential form d omega over some boundary del H. Now, remember, we can get rid of that boundary operator by putting a co-boundary operator on the differential form. So we use Stokes' theorem to go this side. So we remove the co-boundary operator to get just the h at the expense of having, we remove the boundary operator at the expense of having an additional co-boundary operator, right? This is what Stokes is saying. You can go right to left, you remove the boundary operator, but you get a co-boundary operator. That's what we have here. So we remove a boundary, we get a co-boundary operator, that's zero. On the other hand, we can go to the right. And we can say, we can remove that co-boundary operator by adding a boundary operator over here. But that's zero too. That's zero because the boundary of a boundary vanishes. Like the half sphere has as its boundary the equator, but the equator is just a circle which doesn't have a boundary. And over here, we have that this is vanishing because d after d is zero. And now we see that really they are zero for the same reason, right? This has to be, d squared has to be zero because the boundary of a boundary is vanishing. And the amazing thing, and what is going so deep here in the mathematics of it, is that this is purely geometric. The boundary of a boundary manifold is empty. And this is purely algebraic. Take a differential form, calculate the exterior derivative of it, which is really just shifting symbols around on paper, just differentiating. And then do that again with suitable anti-symmetrizations and so on. And you find that that's vanishing. And now we see that it's vanishing for the same reason. It's got to be the same thing. So for that reason, it makes sense to call this the co-boundary operator. So what we see is that Stokes' theorem links very deeply a series of so-called homology, which is the business of manifolds and their boundaries, to cohomology, which is the business of differential forms and their co-boundaries, roughly speaking. So it's mixing, or it's relating geometric information to algebraic information. Stokes' theorem has several important special cases. Here's the first special case. Manifold is just R. Okay? And the region in the manifold that we will consider is simply the open interval from A to B. Doesn't get any easier than that. So what's the boundary of that manifold? Well, the boundary of that manifold is just the endpoints of the interval. So points A and B. So what is Stokes' theorem then? Well, Stokes' theorem says that the integral over exterior derivative of a function is equal to the integral over the function over the boundary of the region. In our case here, we are integrating from A to B, our region, a differential df. And according to Stokes' theorem, this is the integral over the boundary, which is just the points A and B of f itself. You see, so here we have the coboundary operator, and we integrate the full region. Here we remove the coboundary operator, but now we have the boundary of the region. So it's just from A to B. So what this is saying is that the integral from A to B of df is the same as evaluating f at the two ends, b minus a. And of course, the integral from A to B, df, the differential, you can spell out, that's df by dx, dx. So the integral over a derivative is equal to the evaluation at the endpoint. It's just a fundamental theorem of calculus. Special case two. Let's say the manifold is R2. The region is some region in R2. It could be a disk or an ellipsoid or something like this. Two-dimensional region. With some closed boundary curve. So if, let's say, G, the region is a disk, then the boundary curve is a circle. And of course, it doesn't have a boundary. Now, let us consider a one form. Let's call it omega. Omega is, as all one forms are, a linear combination of the basis vectors dx1 and dx2 once we choose a chart. And the coefficient functions can be position dependent, omega 1 of x, omega 2 of x. Let us take the exterior derivative of it. You see, this thing we can integrate because it's one form of a one-dimensional submanifold, such as a circle. If we take the d of it, then we get a two form. We can integrate that over a two-dimensional region, such as a disk. So what is d omega? Well, in order to calculate d omega, we can use our anti-Leibniz rule. We have to apply the d to this, leaving that the same, plus leaving this the same and applying the d to that. And then we do a similar thing over here. Okay, so what is that again? We apply the exterior derivative on this. Well, that gives us d omega by dxi multiplied with dxi. Well, let me spell it out. Okay, again. The d needs to be applied to this, leaving that the same, and the d needs to be applied to that, leaving this the same. When we apply d to this, it goes away, it's d squared. So we only have to worry about applying the d to omega 1. What it does is we get d omega 1 by dx1 veg dx1. That's the first term, which will go away because dx1 veg dx1 is 0, anti-symmetric. Then we get a term where we have d omega 1 differentiated with respect to dx2. Okay? So we get the dx2 over here, veg dx1. That's a contribution. We get that one. But let's reorder it so that we have dx1, dx2. So we get a minus sign. That's this term here. D omega 1 by dx2, dx2, veg dx1. That's that term. Over here, same story. We differentiate this with respect to dx1. So we get here d omega 2 by dx1 veg dx2. And the other term goes away because we will get a dx2 veg dx2. All right. So our differential two form now looks like this. This is the coefficient function, and this is the two form. Then Stokes' theorem, which says that if we integrate over our two-dimensional region, which might be a disk, our two form, like this thing here, we get the same as if we integrate over the boundary, which might be a circle, the one form. So if we integrate this two form here, this one, if we integrate this two form over our region here, like the disk, I put two integral signs here just to indicate it's a two-dimensional integral. But of course, that's just old-fashioned calculus notation. Really, we only need one integral symbol here. By Stokes' theorem, it's the same as integrating over the boundary, which is the circle, the one form. You may recognize this theorem as Green's theorem. Has everybody seen Green's theorem before? Maybe in electromagnetism? Who has seen contour integration? Most of you. Do you see that this is the same? The same thing. Basically, a complex function maps from R2 into R2. Right? Because the complex plane you can view as R2, equipped with some extra structure. So complex function maps R2 into R2. And a complex function is analytic or holomorphic if it obeys the Cauchy-Riemann equations. And the Cauchy-Riemann equations are the equations that say that this stuff is vanishing. It's exactly that. Which is to say that the left-hand side vanishes, and this contour integration is zero. So what it says is that if you have a function from R2 into R2, which has this property that it obeys this Cauchy-Riemann equations, then you have that this contour integration vanishes. Now you may wonder, well, but what if there are singularities? What if there are residues to be taken into account in complex integration? Well, that comes up as well, because if you have a singularity, that's a hole in your manifold. It provides a boundary. You have to integrate around that too. And that gives you another contribution to this. Yep?
Did you at any point define what the integral symbol does?
Yes. Over, how was it? I know that was earlier. Integrate an n-form over an n-dimensional manifold, and that manifold may be a sub-manifold of a bigger one, is given by that. Okay? All right, more examples. Special case number 3. And part of it will be an exercise for you. Don't have to hand it in, just a suggestion. You may know a theorem under the name of Stokes' theorem, again from electromagnetism, which goes like this. Let's say we are studying vector fields in R3, and W is a vector field in R3, a three-component vector field in R3. Then, using this Nabla symbol, you can define what is called the curl of that vector field. Remember, this is this anti-symmetric combination of partial derivatives. Then you get out something that looks like a vector field, but as we discussed earlier, it's really a two-form. And you can integrate that over a two-dimensional submanifold of your R3. And let's call that two-dimensional submanifold A. So then you integrate that over your two-dimensional manifold. Then by that version of Stokes' theorem, this is equal to calculating the integral over just the boundary of that two-dimensional submanifold, where you integrate your vector field along just that boundary. So for example, this could be a half sphere, and this could be the equator. So an integral over the half sphere over the curl of a vector field gives you the integral over just the equator of the vector field. And again, that works out because the cross product with the Nabla operator really gives you a two form. It's really an exterior derivative. And that's a one form. This, if this is a covector field, this is a one form, and you can integrate that over the one-dimensional boundary, such as the equator. So explicitly, our region would be A in this case. It's two-dimensional. Our omega is a one form. The W really has to be a one form omega. And the Nabla cross this one form is the two form that you obtain by taking the exterior derivative here. And then having the exterior derivative, I'm already giving away the solution to the exercise, but all right, if you have the d omega over here, then you can remove the coboundary operator over here so that you're only left with omega, and then you get the boundary operator here on the region. Okay. Special case number four. That's the very important special case of Gauss's theorem. And for that purpose, we will need this a volume form. Remember, we defined the volume form earlier. A volume form is just an n form in an n-dimensional manifold, an n form which is never zero. We can use the volume form to define yet another kind of derivative. Sorry to bury you in derivatives here, but and we are even not done once we have that one. We still need the covariant derivative. Okay, so another derivative, the divergence. You remember the divergence of a vector field came up probably in some context in electromagnetism. Now, what is the divergence of a vector field really, abstractly? The divergence of a vector field, it's called the vector field psi, is defined always relative to a volume form. Can't define the divergence without a volume form. Now, with respect to the volume form, the divergence of a vector field is defined as the lead derivative of the volume form in the direction of the vector field. That this is a useful definition is not clear at this point. It will turn out to be useful because it turns out that this is actually the D of something. And when you have something that's the D of something, in Stokes' theorem, you get something out of it. Because you can remove the D by turning it into a boundary, right? Remember that the lead derivative is the exterior derivative after the inner derivative plus the inner derivative after the exterior derivative, right? It's the anti-commutator of D and I. So let's see what we get when we do that. So the divergence of a vector field with respect to the n form, to the volume form omega, is of course again an n form because the lead derivative of a tensor of a certain rank is again a tensor of that rank. The lead derivative of an S form is an S form. So the divergence of a vector field is given by, remember, this is the lead derivative, right? We showed that the lead derivative is this. It's the anti-commutator of the exterior and the inner derivation. Okay, so we apply the lead derivative now on the n form. And as I promised, this is the d of something. Why? Well, let's see. If you apply the d after the inner derivation on omega, you get this term. It's d after the inner derivation of omega. And then you have also that term, but this one goes away because here we have the d acting on an n form. That would give us an n plus 1 form, but those always vanish. You can't anti-symmetrize more than n basis vectors. So that term goes away. We're just left with this, and that's the whole purpose. That's the reason why we define the divergence in this way. It's that we have a d on the left. Something that, using Stokes' theorem, we can remove at the cost of introducing a boundary operator. So let's do that. We use Stokes' theorem. Stokes' theorem says that the d of the inner derivation, oh, I need to show you that too. Okay, so the divergence of a vector field is d after the inner derivation. Okay, by Stokes' theorem, the integral over that thing, over this, the integral over d inner derivation of the volume form is given by, well, remove that at the expense of putting the boundary operator over here. So it's the integral over the boundary of our region of just the inner derivation. And we can write this in the following form. This here is, as we just saw, this is the divergence of a vector field, which we can integrate over a region. And this here is, here we have an N form, which we integrate over the boundary of that region. And that is actually, when you spell it out, Gauss's law. This is Gauss's theorem. May not be so obvious now, but let me show you. I mean, to make this plausible, why this is Gauss's law as you've seen it earlier, I have to show you what the divergence really looks like, whether the divergence really boils down to what you have seen earlier as the divergence of a vector field. Okay, what is the divergence in a chart? Let's say omega is our volume form. A of x is the coordinate function, and so on. In what follows, you may always, just for fun, think of A as being a constant. Okay? You can always choose this as a volume form. It's nowhere zero. And it's instructive because you see how stuff simplifies and becomes closer to what you've seen earlier. Okay, so let's say omega is our volume form. A of x is an arbitrary, always positive function, let's say, but we can choose it to be constant, just one. Then let's say xi is a tangent vector. We calculate its divergence. What is it going to be? Okay, so the divergence of the vector field is given by the lead derivative of the volume form by definition. And what is that? Well, the lead derivative of an N form gives us, if you remember, the lead derivative by the Leibniz rule, the lead derivative of the coefficient function, leaving the rest the same, plus, and then we have to apply the lead derivative on all the other stuff in there. So we start out with this. The lead derivative on the coefficient function, A, is, well, the lead derivative of a function in a direction xi is just xi applied to the function, because a vector field is already the directional derivative on function. So the lead derivative in the direction of xi onto a coefficient function A is simply the vector field applied to A, the directional derivative applied to A. And then we have, by the Leibniz rule property of the lead derivative, also to leave the A the same and then differentiate any one of those terms in here, any one of those basis vectors in the cotangent space. But what are these guys? Well, remember that the lead derivative of a covector is the of a one form is the exterior derivative of the directional derivative. This is the statement that the directional derivative of the exterior derivative is the exterior derivative of the directional derivative. Okay, I spell that out. Exterior derivative of directional derivative of xi. Directional derivative acting on xi. We can work out what that is. It's just the Kronecker delta. These are the coefficient functions in here. We sum over the j. We just get the exterior derivative of the coefficient function xi. And that's just dxi by dxr dxr. Okay, so the lead derivative of this particular one form is given by this. So we get the sum over all possible dxrs. So when we take the lead derivative of all those guys, we're going to, of the dxi, we are going to get a term with a dx1 in it, a dx2 in it, a dx3 in it, but only the dxi term will survive, because otherwise we will have the same dxi as one of those over here, and then by anti-symmetry it goes away. So in this whole sum, only the term with the I will survive, and we get that factor in here. So overall, what we get is this derivative, the derivative of the coefficient function here. Remember, the comma means partial derivative d by dxi. That's this first term. Plus, leaving the a the same, and then we have dxi I by dxi, and all those terms. It's just, you know, only this one term survives per application of the Leibniz rule. And then you see we have the product of xi and a here and there. Once the a is differentiated, and here the xi is differentiated, so we can really put this in here and differentiate it there. So overall, the divergence of a vector field takes this simple form. Do you recognize how that is the divergence as you've seen it earlier? Remember, the divergence of a vector field was, if the vector field had components v1, v2, v3, what was the divergence? It was dv1 by dx1 plus dv2 by dx2 plus dv3 by dx3. That's there. Just think of A as being constant. If A is constant, if the volume form is constant, A is constant, A is constant, and all we have here is dxi by xi, dxi I by dxi, summed over I. The xi I are the coefficients of the vector, right? So it's dxi 1 by dx1 plus dxi 2 by dx2 plus dxi 3 by dx3. So really, and that's just a constant too. So really, it's just the ordinary definition of divergence, except that we now notice too that the divergence is not a scalar. It's tempting to think that if you have a vector field and you calculate dxi 1 by dx1 plus dx2 by dxi 2 by dx2 plus dxi 3 by dx3, that what you get is a scalar. It's not. It's an n-form, right? The divergence of a vector field is an n-form because it's the Lie derivative of an n-form. The Lie derivative of an s-form is an s-form. And that's why the divergence has funny transformation properties. It doesn't transform like a scalar. It transforms like an n-form. And an n-form transforms pretty much like a scalar, except that it is a little bit moody when it comes to changing the left-handed to right-handed. Then it picks up a minus sign, where scalars don't. All right. So now we have differentiation. We define differentiations, namely the exterior derivative, the inner derivation, and the Lie derivative, where the inner derivation is simply plugging xi into the first argument of a differential form. That's all it does, right? It's nothing fancy. It's interesting to know that plugging xi as the first argument into a differential form has the property of a derivation. It's an antiderivation of degree minus 1. But really, that's all it is. It's just plugging in xi as the first argument into a differential form. The exterior derivative has the meaning of being the co-boundary operator. It does to differential forms what the boundary operator does to regions. And Lxi is the generalization of the directional derivative, not only for functions, but for vectors and for tensors in general. And for differential forms, it takes particularly simple forms and expressions. And we define integration. We can now integrate over arbitrary regions, arbitrary differential forms, as long as the degree of the form matches the dimension of the region. What we have not defined yet is the notion of distance. One might think that we had it, but no. The distance between points so far is completely undefined. Even though we have a notion of volume, we don't have a notion of distance yet. Why do I say I don't have a notion of distance? Can't we say two points on the manifold are close or are far away from each other? No, we can't really say that. Don't have any handle on that yet. And the reason is that the numerical distance between the coordinates of two points, let's say one point has coordinates x1 to xn, and another point has coordinates x1 plus epsilon 1 up until xn plus epsilon n, the numerical distance between those two points and the coordinate distance has absolutely no meaning. I could choose a different coordinate system in which that coordinate system distance is tremendous. Or I could choose another coordinate system in which that numerical coordinate distance is arbitrarily small. So we really have no way of telling whether two points are close or far away from each other as yet. This is not a matter of two points having a certain distance and we just don't know it yet. It's a matter of two points not having a distance. On differential manifolds, if you take two arbitrary points, there is no notion of distance in between them. The whole thing is totally rubbery. It's like the stuff a trampoline is made of. You can't speak of the distance between two points. It's just not defined yet. Obviously, in space-time, there is such a thing as a distance between things, and therefore, we need additional mathematical structure to explain it. So it's not a matter of discovering it in the manifold. We still have to put the information in there. We still have to add mathematical structure that will allow two points to have an actual distance from each other. So let's remember from special relativity, if two points P and Q have coordinates x and x plus epsilon in an inertial coordinate system, then in special relativity, the distance is given by this expression in terms of their numerical coordinate distance. Numerically, the coordinates differ by epsilon naught to epsilon 3, and the invariance distance between two events in Minkowski space is given by minus epsilon squared plus the epsilon I squared, which is conveniently combined in this expression. It's eta mu nu, epsilon nu, where the eta is this matrix here. And that matrix is the same in all inertial coordinate systems. And that's the basis of special relativity. Lorentz transformations are those linear maps which leave that metric invariant. Now, by the equivalence principle, that's a matter of physics, there always exist local inertial coordinate systems in which this distance formula must hold for small distances. So that gives us a hint as to what mathematical structure we should add to our differentiable manifolds. And here's the definition. We turn our differentiable manifold into a Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian manifold by introducing what is called a Riemannian or a pseudo-Riemannian metric. A Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian metric on a manifold is a covariant two-tensor. It's a covariant two-tensor field that we may call G. So for every point in the manifold, we get a covariant symmetric two-tensor. It has to obey, just a sec. In order to be called a metric, our two-tensor, our two-tensor field has to obey these properties. It has to, as a covariant two-tensor, it feeds on two tangent vectors, and it has to map two tangent vectors into a real number. Well, that's what every covariant two-tensor does. It feeds on two tangent vectors and gives you a real number for it, or a number-valued function for it. But it has to do it in a way that is symmetric. So the two-tensor, when fed two tangent vectors, will give you the same no matter which way you feed the tangent vectors. And notice that we are not choosing charts here. We're not choosing coordinates. This is just a general abstract requirement. And we also require that the covariant two-tensor that is supposed to be a metric gives us zero for all vectors xi in the tangent vector space only if eta is actually the zero vector. So it doesn't have a kernel as a map, as a matrix. So if you have that this comes out zero for all xi, then you can deduce that eta has to be zero. That means that G is not degenerate. We will call such a G a Riemannian metric if the output of feeding it the same tangent vector twice is always positive, and if that's not the case, then we will call it a Lorentzian metric. A differentiable manifold together with a such a Riemannian or Lorentzian metric is called a Riemannian manifold or pseudo-Riemannian or Lorentzian manifold. Maybe I should clarify the terminology. A Riemannian manifold means that the metric is positive definite. If the metric is not positive definite, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a Lorentzian manifold. It is always called a pseudo-Riemannian manifold, but it's called a Lorentzian manifold only if the signature, and we will define in a moment what the signature is, or we will define soon what the signature is, if the signature has only one time direction. In principle, you could have, you know, a 27-dimensional manifold, and you could have 13 time directions and 14 spatial directions, right? That would not be a Riemannian manifold. It would also not be a Lorentzian manifold. It would be called a pseudo-Riemannian manifold. And it's Lorentzian if there's only one time variable. Only one time-like direction. Now let us write out a metric in a basis. So let's assume that that we choose a basis in the space of cotangent vectors. Yep?
Sorry, do we really have the ability to measure volumes without a metric any more so than we can measure distances? Because you said the volume form isn't unique.
Well, what I wanted to say is that before introducing a metric, you can introduce a volume form. And you can... I'm not saying that this will describe space-time, but it does make sense. It has the usual additivity properties for volumes. Now, when you do introduce a metric, and therefore distances, then you may want to reconsider what you use as your volume form. Because the metric, once you know how to measure distances, induces automatically a volume form for you. And so, in order not to have two competing volume forms around, you might just discard whatever you used earlier and go with the volume form that comes with a metric. And that's what general relativity does. I'm just pointing out that the mathematics allows for two separate notions there.
But supposing we could lay one chart on the entire manifold, can we just pick that one and say this is what we're measuring distances in the same way that...
Oh no, that would be chart dependent.
Well, chart dependent, yes. But
yeah, but then, yeah. Yeah, but it's very different. I mean, charts are just giving names to points. The physics can never depend on that. Okay, let's continue. I hope to finish soon. So let's say we choose in the tangent vector space a basis. Let's say the theta I are a basis in the tangent vector space. You can choose for this basis the differentials of coordinate functions, dxi, but you don't have to. So this is just a choice of basis in the cotangent vector spaces. At every point, you get to choose a new basis, because at every point you have a new tangent space, you can choose the basis. Then we can use this basis to express our metric tensor. We can write the metric tensor as gij, and then basis vector, tensor, basis vector. See, this is a cotangent vector. That's a cotangent vector. That's a tensor product. So overall, this is a 0-2 tensor. It's a covariant, a twofold covariant tensor, and this is just coefficient functions, right? This is not a tensor. This is just coefficient functions. Now, for every choice of basis in the cotangent vector space, there is a corresponding dual choice of basis in the tangent vector space. Let us call that basis, the dual basis to the thetas. Let's call it EI. And they are dual by definition if and only if we choose them such that the theta I on the ER gives us the Kronecker delta. Okay? So now, when we take our 0-2 tensor, the metric, and we feed it two tangent vectors, namely two basis vectors of the dual basis to the theta, then we obtain, remember that the GIK, theta I, theta j form the metric. And now we feed the first tangent vector to this cotangent vector and the second one to that cotangent vector. This gives us just Kronecker deltas, and so we obtain here a matrix, GRS. These are the matrix elements of the metric when we evaluate it on two tangent vectors. Remember that these entries, in principle, have nothing to do with the choice of coordinate system. They have everything to do with the choice of bases, theta and epsilon and E, but the choice of coordinate system didn't come into this. Now, a manifold M is called Lorentzian if, for all points P, there is a choice of bases such that that matrix here is just the eta matrix that we had earlier from special relativity with the minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Then it is called Lorentzian. There's one time and the rest is base coordinates. A lot of people also call it Lorentzian when there are more dimensions, as long as there's just one time dimension. All right, we will pick up from there next time. Once we have the metric, we can do covariant derivatives, and then before you know it, we do equations of motion. Okay?